Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's morning again in America.
No, wait, sorry, turn that up. Sorry, wrong election. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 5th of November. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. And apologies, of course, to the 1984 Ronald Reagan campaign, but it does kind of seem appropriate. No, it was a very good night for the GOP last night, a very bad night for the president and his party. Let us, though, business and economy program that we are, look at things through a non-political lens, a more market-based approach, if you will. Equities did fine today. The Dow is back at a record high. But what else is out there? Well, commodities. Now, there is something interesting. Pretty much across the board, commodities were down today. Gold, wheat, palladium, for crying out loud, all lost ground, in part because the dollar is strong. The dollar is strong because the economy is strong. And if you follow the logic train with me here for just a second, the economy is going to keep on getting stronger because Washington is not going to do too much about it the next 2 years. The gridlock, by and large, will continue. That will naturally drive a lot of Americans crazy. But for investors, the status quo brings certainty. And as we have said, I cannot tell you how many times, businesses love them some certainty. Marketplace's David Gura gets us going this day after.
Congress could tackle tax reform. Lawmakers could pass a budget. But what's more likely to be on the agenda is gridlock and dysfunction.
For the most part, it's going to be largely a replay of the last few years.
David Lefkowitz is a senior equity strategist with UBS, and he says the men and women in his profession can deal with that.
To the extent that we just have a continuation of the status quo, but maybe with a slightly different flavor, investors can sort of get their arms around that and understand what that means.
And there's this belief, according to Russ Kostrich, BlackRock's chief investment strategist,
that having divided government prevents either party from their worst excesses, and generally divided government's associated with better market returns.
A caveat from Kostrich, that is based more on instinct than historical evidence. Greg Valaire, the Potomac Research Group's chief political strategist, says Wall Street has grown accustomed to the way Washington works, or doesn't.
I talk to a lot of professional investors, and many of them sort of roll their eyes when you talk to them about Washington.
And while they can make do, especially when the economy's on the upswing and the dollar is strong, David Lefkowitz from UBS says investors can get impatient.
We still will have the budget battles, and we'll have to raise the debt ceiling next year.
Two big debates that have led to government shutdowns that have put the country's credit rating at risk are not far off. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
When you talk to people outside the Washington Beltway, a funny thing happens. You start to get a sense of what is actually going on. In life, yes, of course, but also in the economy. We've got a guy we talk to every now and then who has always got that slice of reality for us. Don Holshue is his name. He's a truck driver in the upper Midwest, Iowa and Minnesota specifically. Mr. Holshue, good to talk to you again, sir.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm well. First of all, we got you not on the road for a change. Last time we talked about a year and a half ago, and every time, in fact, you've literally pulled over on the side of the road.
That's right.
How's business? What are your hardware store customers telling you?
Well, I think last time I talked, it's about the same. At a couple stores that went out of business.
Interesting that you say it's about the same because, you know, I mean, the big national numbers are that it's actually better. You're not feeling it, clearly.
No, I mean, that's all on Wall Street. You know, if you've got lots of money, you're doing fine. It's just us or not.
What are you feeling then?
Well, I had to increase working, you know, take about an extra run to get by. That's pretty bad.
You took more hours. Is that what you're doing?
Took more hours.
So how many hours a week are you working now?
Let's see, 60 hours, 61 hours.
Which you had to do to get by?
To get by, to stay even what I used to make in 4.5 days.
How can that be? That doesn't make any sense.
I don't know. Yeah, you've been to the grocery store?
I have.
Right. You look at the baskets, everything's gone up. the $20 bills is the new $1 bill.
Let me ask you about the cost of actual just physical driving. How much are you paying for a gallon of diesel for your truck now?
Well, now it's $3.54 in Iowa.
Yeah, is that helping you out at all?
I mean, it is. It's helping the company, but it's still, you know, way too high. It's a dollar more than gas.
How old are you?
59.
It's almost time to start thinking about retirement, right?
Ah, like I told you before, forget it. I'll probably be working until I'm 68.
Another 10? You got another 10 years in you?
Well, another 10 years, another 1,025,000 miles.
Miles. Yeah, well, yeah. We should say at this point, you've been driving 36 years, 4.5 million miles, accident-free, right?
That's right, safe.
There you go, which is what counts. But the point is, you're going to be out there at the age of 68 doing 62 hours behind the wheel of a truck?
Well, there's nothing else. What else am I going to get a job at? Like I talk to everybody else, it's the same thing. What, am I working a gas station? Work three jobs in a gas station to get by? You know, the minimum wage, they keep talking about raising that. I haven't had a raise for 15 years.
Is your house paid off? You still paying a mortgage?
No, that's why I'm working until 68.
You're still paying a mortgage?
Still paying the mortgage.
Yeah. What about your wife, Mr. Hosher? What does she think about all this stuff?
Well, I mean, she thinks it's a pity that this stuff has turned out like this, that we have to end up working so late. You know, I mean, it doesn't seem fair.
What happens if you get to 68 and you still can't get by?
I'll be over at your house.
Yeah, it's a long drive. It's a long drive out to California.
That's okay. No, I don't know. I mean, it's you can't worry about it.
Don Holshue drives a truck throughout the upper Midwest, Iowa and Minnesota. Mr. Holshue, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thanks, good buddy. We'll talk to you later.
You don't actually say on the radio, on the CB radio, you don't actually say good buddy, do you?
No, I haven't turned on the radio, CB radio, for 26 years.
All right. Thanks for your time, sir.
Thank you.
10-4, good buddy. Wall Street today, two up, one down. Details, numbers, you guys know the drill. Lost, just possibly, in all the national and gubernatorial races yesterday was a measure on the ballot down in Denton, Texas. It's a growing middle-class college town smack in the middle of fracking country. Our man on the oil beat, Scott Tong, was down there a week or two ago telling us about a voter proposition to ban fracking. And banned it was last night, 59-41%. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports that the vote has put fossil fuel supporters on the defensive and on the phone to their lawyers.
Denton is the first city in Texas to ban fracking. It's already home to more than 270 fracked wells. Some are quite close to homes, says Kathy McMullen. She led the local anti-fracking campaign.
We have to have some accountability by this industry to understand that you cannot industrialize a neighborhood or a school or a park. People are just not going to stand for that.
Fracking supporters wasted no time hitting back. The Texas Oil and Gas Association was in state court this morning asking for an injunction. Thomas Phillips, a former state Supreme Court justice, is one of the group's attorneys. He argues Texas law is pretty clear on the matter.
No city can just take it upon itself to say, not in my backyard.
Other Texas legal scholars disagree, but what is clear is that the Denton vote has the industry nervous. They fear it will embolden anti-fracking forces around the country. Chris Faulkner is CEO of Breitling Energy, based in Dallas. He wouldn't say how much his company spent fighting the Denton measure, but he predicts residents there will regret their vote.
Well, Denton better have a lot of money put aside for their litigation fees. They could end up, like what happened in Colorado, getting the moratorium overturned, meaning they accomplished nothing and spent a great deal of money doing so.
New York, however, has upheld local fracking bans. Ed Ireland, head of the Barnett Shell Energy Education Council, says the vast majority of oil and gas wells drilled in the U.S. now are hydraulically fractured. This fight, he says, is a lot bigger than Denton, Texas. I'm Sarah Gardner from Marketplace.
A story now about emojis, those smiley faces and pictograms that people send with their text messages. They are about to get a lot more diverse. The governing body for those graphics, and yes, there is such a thing, says it's going to update its code so the faces on emojis can have a range of human skin tones because, believe it or not, those little images are actually big business. Nova Sappho explains.
The growth market for emoticons is in messaging apps like Viber and WhatsApp. And to understand just how big that market's gotten, I knew exactly who to call. Hi, Mom.
Hi.
My mom sends me those graphic stickers on Viber all the time.
Why do you use them?
Because these stickers are a new style and looks good. I try to express my love to you in a new way.
The fact that even my mom is using emoticons says volumes about how popular they've become.
Why punch out 5 characters to express yourself when you can punch 1 character and say it all?
Ram Menon's company Avamo provides businesses with a secure messaging app, which includes emoticons. He says it's natural for us to communicate in images.
There's a lot of things we try to express at work. We translated that into emojis, like, anybody ready for lunch? Kill me now.
Kill me now, by the way, is just a guy with a gun to his head.
The emoticon market is a super high growth market right now.
That's Evan Ray. He's the CEO of Swift Media, which sells packs of emoticons and digital stickers to a younger audience, most of whom are in their teens.
We work with a lot of major movie studios, and we're seeing a lot of success from entertainment brands. Actually, surprisingly, one of our really big packs is actually Betty Boop.
All of this adds up. The Japanese messaging app Line said last year it was making about $10 million a month just from digital sticker sales. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Should you be curious about the difference between an emoji and an emoticon, and they are apparently quite different, we have just the thing for you. Our digital team here has made an emoji of me. You can check it out if you feel you must. I won't be offended if you don't at marketplace.org. Yesterday wasn't just election day. You know, there was economic news to be had as well. The Commerce Department told us that the trade gap hit $43 billion in September. We have been running, in point of fact, a trade deficit every single year since 1974. So, riddle me this. Is that necessarily a bad thing? Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has the story.
A trade deficit doesn't sound super great.
Trade deficit is when a country is importing more than it's exporting.
Doug Irwin teaches economics at Dartmouth. If I ran a trade deficit for 40 years, like the U.S. has, I would be broke. But I'm not a country.
There's actually nothing necessarily wrong about a trade deficit. In fact, here's where economists always have a definitive answer to the question, is a trade deficit good or bad? And that definitive answer is, it depends.
It depends because there's this whole other hidden side to trade deficits that is weirdly all about debt and investment, and it's kind of invisible unless you look at the money. So here is our trade deficit with Europe.
Bonjour, this is Stereotypique French Bakery.
Oh, hi. Yeah, hi, it's America.
Oh, it's you again.
Yeah, listen, I would like to buy a shipping container of croissants.
Okay.
Croissants. Croissants. Mm-hmm. The little curly cue.
Okay, wonderful. So it will be 10,000 euros.
Right. Listen, can I just pay you in dollars? Okay, that would be a lot easier for me.
No, madame, this is France. You pay in euros here. We don't take dollars.
To import, America has to go get euros.
To get other countries' currencies, you have to sell some dollars that you have on the foreign exchange market.
Hi, everybody. It's America. Listen, does anyone have any euros? I need to trade these dollars in because little Miss Attitude over there is not taking dollars.
So when America imports stuff, at some point along the way, dollars have to get traded for euros. But here is the weird problem. If we have a trade deficit, then other countries aren't buying that much stuff from us, which means they don't need our dollars.
Anyone want these dollars?
And if they don't need our dollars, we don't get euros.
Germany, don't you need some dollars to buy beer or something?
So if the rest of the world isn't buying much of our stuff, how are we getting all the euros to buy all the stuff we're importing from the rest of the world?
Money has to come from somewhere.
Yeah, how am I going to get my croissants without enough euros?
Now, in reality, it turns out there are people abroad who do want to give us euros in exchange for dollars. These are not people who want to buy our stuff, though. These are people who need dollars because they want to invest in America. They are investors.
Oh, hello, America.
I'd be delighted to offer you these euros in exchange for your dollars. You see, I'm rather fond of your stock markets.
Don't get handsy.
After all, the NASDAQ doesn't take euros, so foreign investors need dollars to park their money in the U.S. and make a profit, just like we need euros to buy croissants. They'll buy things like
treasury bills, real estate, stock, and other financial assets.
That's how the U.S. economy finds the euros to go import crazy. So if we are having a trade deficit, it is a sign that someone somewhere abroad is investing in some part of our economy. A trade deficit and investment are like two sides of a weird coin. We buy goods from the world invests in us.
Financing the trade deficit by investing in the United States.
This invisible connection between trade deficits and foreign investment is why a trade deficit can be good or bad. All it means for sure is that other countries are coming to you to invest their money. That can be great if it's growing your economy, or it can be bad if it's not. You can't really tell what's going on just from having a trade deficit. The U.S. is lucky because investors keep coming back. And as long as they do, we can import more than we export. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up, you know, Moore's Law does not apply here. We're not, you know, putting more computing power into these things. We actually have to figure out new ways to make them.
Which is what is standing between me and my wall-sized TV, you guys. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 0.5% today, 100 points. The century mark closed at a record high, 17,484. The NASDAQ, not so much, though, slipped to less than a 0.1%, 2 points, closed at 4620. S&P 500 was up 0.5%, 11 points, 2023. Financials mostly feeling fine. J.P. Morgan Chase climbed 1.5%. Bank of America deposited 0.75% today. Energy stocks were re-energized by hopes that the new Republican majority would mean more oil and gas pipelines approved. Chevron shares fueled up 1.5%. Marathon Oil ticked up 0.6% today. Bond prices, well, they fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.34%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues its preliminary productivity and cost report for the third quarter. Some chain stores release retail sales data for October. Have you seen holiday stuff out yet? And speaking of, remember Hermie, the elf who wanted to be a dentist? He's immortalized on a postage stamp. The U.S. Postal Service issues stamps featuring characters from Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. That includes the Bumble. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A lasting vestige of the Great Depression, that is depression, not recession, went away last month. The federal program meant to help tobacco farmers transition from the quota system they used 80 years ago to the freer markets of today has ended. The last of what were known as tobacco buyout checks were distributed last month. Farmers and tobacco producers in North Carolina got more than a third of the $9.6 billion in recent buyout payments under that program. North Carolina Public Radio's Leonita Inge tells us about one tobacco farmer who saved his farm by going organic.
Stanley Hughes and his workers at Pine Knot Farms have spent the month bringing in the last of the tobacco out of the fields. 66-year-old Hughes has lived on this farm all of his life. His grandfather purchased the land more than 100 years ago. Tobacco has been grown here ever since, but it hasn't been easy.
Only thing about farming, you can keep a job, work all the time, and stay broke.
Hughes and many other smaller tobacco farmers are familiar with the broke years. U.S. tobacco prices peaked in the mid-1990s and then began falling off. Cigarette taxes went up, the number of U.S. smokers went down, and tobacco was cheaper abroad. Hughes had to do something. He learned during a workshop he could get a higher price for his tobacco if it was grown organically.
We started off with 1 acre, then we got up to probably 5 acres before I went totally organic.
By 2000, Hughes switched all the way over. Everything he raised, from collard greens to tobacco, was organic. And when the tobacco buyout was approved in 2004, he requested his money in one lump sum instead of in 10 yearly payments.
He was one of the people that diversified.
Archie Hart is a program specialist with the North Carolina Department of Agriculture. He's very familiar with Hughes's operation.
He's known as the Carler's man. He's also does sweet potatoes. So he was one of the people that you can look at and say, okay, he took advantage of the buyout and he diversified and he has an income stream coming in as a result of that.
It's all paid off. Hughes ships his tobacco directly to Santa Fe Natural Tobacco Company, an independent operation of Reynolds American. It manufactures the American Spirit brand. And he's been named Farmer of the Year a couple of times in the Carolinas. And his collards have been featured in Gourmet magazine. Despite all his success, Hughes is not one to brag.
I ain't not think I'm doing great or exciting, you know.
Really?
No, just working.
In North Carolina, I'm Leonita Inge for Marketplace.
Rite Aid has Christmas lights on its shelves. Starbucks has brought out the red cups, so I guess it is now official. The holiday shopping season is upon us. For those who keep track of these sorts of things, we are going to spend, says the Consumer Electronics Association, $33 billion on gadgets and electronics this year. No small amount of that will be on big screen TVs, which gets us to the latest installment of our series, Screen Wars.
Got this. No money down.
That one's in the dirt.
On a brighter note, commercial break.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech, here to make me smart on big screens and the economics thereof. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai, I got a question for you.
All right, man, hit me.
What's the biggest screen you have in your house?
Yo, I think it is 40 inches, yes.
40 inches, yes. Television, okay.
Yes.
I want to talk about this because we're not quite where I would like us to be, which is I would like you to have an entire wall of your house be a video screen. And
okay.
I want to talk to you about why that isn't yet. A lot of people, they're doing their holiday shopping right now.
Yeah.
And I think the best thing they can get is, as near as I can tell, I'm just looking at Samsung as an example here. Best thing they can get is 110 inches diagonal, ultra high def, 4K TV. It only costs, Kai, $39,000, $999.99.
Okay.
You know,
so a couple of things. I've got four college educations to pay for. But why? I mean, assuming one wanted a wall-size screen, why couldn't one have one?
So part of the issue is how we manufacture this stuff, right? These screens are really complicated to make. I talked to a couple of engineers who deal with this stuff.
Yeah.
And the tricky part is these screens, they use these tiny, teeny, tiny little transistors that are all laid under glass, which, as you know, is a pretty brittle material,
yes,
right? And if you screw this up, if you're making one of these things and you get one little tiny transistor wrong, after you've manufactured this, you actually have to throw the whole thing out. So the overhead for making this stuff is actually really complicated, and it's hard to ship this stuff. So they're hoping that they can actually innovate in this area, and people have been working on it for a while, but we're not quite there yet.
So I'm gathering that Moore's Law does not apply here, right? Because I have in my pocket right now in the studio, well, not in the studio because I don't bring my phone to the studio, but I have sitting on my desk in my office more computing power in my phone than took people to the moon, and yet we can't figure out how to get me, should I so desire, a wall-sized television screen for Christmas at something less than $4 gazillion.
Right. You know, Moore's Law does not apply here. We're not, you know, putting more computing power into these things. We actually have to figure out new ways to make them. And that means maybe making screens that are flexible. Sony's actually been working on this. They made something called digital paper that is actually a flexible screen. But still, even if you want to actually build a factory that makes the kinds of TVs that you and I have in our houses right now, it costs like $100 million just to make the factory that makes these things because it's a really complex process. But this is why we have this problem of not being able to make giant wall screens.
It's kind of interesting, that barrier between a 40-inch screen that I can get probably at Costco for $500 versus the really giant ones that eventually everybody's going to want.
Right. You may have heard several weeks back, Google X Labs, this place where they're doing all this exciting Google stuff, they're starting to work on modular screens, like little almost tablet-sized screens that you can that all can plug into each other. And so that's one way of going at this. I think it may actually be more likely that we do the virtual reality headset thing. You've seen this stuff, right? The Oculus Rift.
I have.
So I think one possible future here is that instead of having a giant fancy digital screen on our wall, we're all wearing
some silly-looking goggles as we walk around the house. And the goggles actually, instead of doing this like 360-degree environment, you could sit down on the couch with your goggles on, and it could project a giant screen on the wall for you. What do you think?
I think that's bananas. That's what I think. I think that's bananas. But you know, you're the tech guy, and I'm not. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, a commentary of sorts on how those who don't remember history can be condemned to repeat it. At his post-election press conference today, President Obama said a whole bunch of nice things about incoming Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, how he's looking forward to working with him, including this.
I would enjoy having some Kentucky bourbon with Mitch McConnell.
All right, fine, collegial and all. Much funnier, though, were the president's comments last year at the White House Correspondents Association dinner about how people want him to make nice with the GOP.
Why don't you get a drink with Mitch McConnell, they ask. Really? Why don't you get a drink with Mitch McConnell?
Oh, yeah, it is going to be an interesting 2 years, y'all. All right, we're done on this post-election day. The Dow up 0.5%. That is 100 points on the nose. The NASDAQ down less than 0.1%, 2 points. The S&P 500 picked up about 0.5% or so, 11 points. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Rayfield, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.